Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Plumbing Game Studies, a games and philosophy podcast. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson. What you're about to hear was not originally designed to be an episode of Plumbing Game Studies. It was an episode of my original podcast, Everyday Anarchism, which is still going strong. Check it out. But this was the episode with Teen Nguyen that was so thrilling that I decided I had to start this new podcast, Plumbing Game Studies. Enjoy! Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, and this episode is going to be a really awesome, I think, mishmash, because I'm talking today with the philosopher Teen Nguyen, who works on games and also on all of these very, you know, on-brand anarchist ideas in terms of James Scott's concepts of seeing like a state and transparency and surveillance. I'm right now working on the philosophy of games for my teaching. And as you know, I work on anarchism. So T and I, we're going to cross the streams here. Yeah. We're going to both come at this question of games and at the question of anarchism and seeing like a state and all together. And I just say, I'm just really excited about this.
Hey, it's good to be here. Maybe you can get me unstuck as we were talking about right before this started. I'm trying to write a book right now, a popular book. And it would have been the sensible, sane thing to do would have been to write either a book about the half of me that wants to talk about the glory of games and the beauty of play, or to write a book from the half of me that wants to talk about metrics, bureaucracy, organization, classification, and what that does. But I've decided to somehow intermingle them. And I've had these experiences, and we're going to try to do a bit of this today, where when I talk about both together, that's when people get like really excited. And it's actually hard for me to put my finger exactly on why, but there's something about we can take stabs. Like, they're both about rule sets. They're both about having clear point structures. And one of the most interesting things to me, the way I've just as of this week been reformulating everything I've been trying to think about, is this question, which is, there are these things, these hyper clear mechanical scoring systems that make incredibly explicit exactly what you're supposed to do. And here's this puzzle. Why is it in one case that they seem to drain the life out of us, right? Why do metrics and clear evaluation systems seem to be the thing that make institutional life the most miserable and empty? But here, this is where everyone stepped in to say that what's wrong is mechanical scoring systems. And here's where, I see you reacting. The other half of me is like, but here's the other thing I know. Some of the most fun I ever have, the most fluid, the most playful events in my life are against the background of a clear scoring system. And there's also this incredibly interesting dialogue. Like, one of the things I know is people from tabletop role-playing game space, especially indie tabletop role-playing space, often say, like, when you have this like purely unstructured, purely playful, purely unrule-bound structure, people actually either can't tell stories or they revert to telling the same stories over and over again. And the weird and interesting thing is, when you add some rule structure, some forced dice rolls, and some experience point structure, then suddenly creativity blooms. And I mean, you should talk, because this is the thing. That tension is the thing that's super interesting to me.
I almost can't speak. I mean, this is as longtime listeners of this podcast will know, this is not a problem I have, but my mind is so on fire. I'll just tell you, I just started a book like yesterday, started writing a book on the philosophy of games. I have never aspired to write a book. Once I started doing the podcasting, I was like, finally, here's something I can do that's not writing a book, because I don't want to write a book. And I've started writing a book. Who knows? Maybe, it's like 100 words right now. Who knows if it'll keep going? And I started writing this book after thinking about your work and putting it in dialogue with Suits, and then also Wittgenstein and Cavell and Austin and these people I'm working on. So like, my brain is bubbling. Normally I'm like, okay, I know what I want to say about this. Maybe not stuck, but I'm at the beginning of the journey. So let me try this. All right. Oh my God. This is not normal for me. I don't know if I'm gonna be able to edit this out or not, but I'm just exploding.
Go.
So the first thing to say is, I have this really expansive definition of anarchism drawn from David Graeber, among other people, in which anarchism is basically just like people working together more or less without someone pointing a gun at them. Like, that's one definition of anarchism. And all my friends just think it's so funny that I'm an anarchist and that I play soccer. You know, like I go to the soccer game and they're like, ha, you're just going to do whatever you want. You're going to use your hands, right? You're an anarchist. And I'm like, no, pickup soccer. I play mostly pickup soccer is the essence of anarchism. Everyone is following these rules precisely in a way that we're not supposed to be able to, according to conventional political theories. There's no boss, there's no referee, no one is in charge. We're so unofficial that we get kicked off the field all the times because someone has filled out a bureaucratic form and they, quote, own the fields. And we also leave, even though there's no one there with a gun to make us leave the fields. We're playing this game that is totally rules bound and also at the same time, completely free flowing, non-hierarchical, non-authoritarian. The score doesn't matter. And yet scoring becomes the essence of your life for that 90 minutes. And just that question of how we are playing this game and what it means to be totally rules bound and also completely free of all rules at the same time has been in the back of my mind for years, ever since I started telling my pickup buddies I was an anarchist and they started explaining that I'm not an anarchist because I'm playing soccer according to the rules. And that's my opening salvo, which isn't a statement, but this isn't like a claim, but it's like the thing I'm working through is making sense of this to people. Actually, one other thing, sorry to respond. There's this amazing tabletop board game designer named Jay Dragon, and Jay's games, if you can describe them that, are like the most anarchist games I've ever seen. And Jay uses the no dice, no masters system, which is a joke. It's no gods, no masters. It's an anarchist slogan. Like anarchism is baked into these games, and I can't figure out how to play them because they're so free that they don't seem to me to be playable. And then this is the dilemma that you were just talking about, is like, wait a second, how can I be such a creature of freedom and want to smash all of these bureaucratic systems? And then what do I do for my spare time? I sit down and read a rule book and explain to people bureaucratic systems that they have to follow for fun. This has my head exploding, T. So now I'm talking to you about it.
Now, I'm just going to put, so I don't have a complete answer for you, but I have a lot of pieces and I can just, let me just start putting pieces on the table.
Please.
So when I was writing my game stuff, I was interested in trying to respond to a bunch of standard like criticisms I had that there were about games. And from one side, there's this very adult, like games are silly and there's an easy, I think, anarchist or Marxist response to this, which is you just think they're silly because you're obsessed with outcomes and production and you've lost sight of the value of activity for its own sake. So this is going to come up a lot, but the phrase philosophers use is autotelic activity. So autotelic activity is activity that you do for the sake of the doing itself rather than the production or outcome. And I think like there's an easy, that's the easy thing to say. But I think there's something even weirder, because that the more interesting worry for me comes from exactly people that are like, when you're playing, why would you use rules? I found a really clear articulation of this in Miguel Sicart, who's a friend of mine, but also, you know, intellectually one of my mortal enemies. And he's on the other side. He's like, play is free. Why would you ever impose rules on play? That is the perversion of play. And that, I can see that argument, but I think I have the same experience that you have, which is games that come out of the philosophy of pure freedom aren't really playable to me, and they don't do the thing, like the magic thing. And this is what I want to think about. So there are a few things we can say. One, a crucial difference between games and, say, metrics and large-scale bureaucratic institutional systems is that what everyone will say, which is that games are voluntary, right? Mm-hmm. You have choice over the games. Now, but this still becomes a little bit complicated, because on the one hand, you choose what game you want and you can mod it in the long term. On the short, in the short scale, though, the experience of playing a game is, especially as a newcomer to a game, to look at the rules and follow them exactly, which is this weird, I totally get it. And, you know, I'm a philosopher that started an existentialism. I can totally see how you would say, like, look, this is a total perversion of freedom. And yet, right? So let me say a few things first. So the first thing to say is, sometimes I have experience where I'm reading rules to somebody and they're like, I want to know why. I want to know why. I want to know why. Like, tell me this. And I have to be like, I don't know. I haven't played this game before, or it's kind of mysterious. And also, it's a sculpted experience. There's something, I mean, this is why I keep reaching for the art, to think of games as an art form. It's that someone has put these things together and carefully tuned them so that if you follow them, follow these rules, you'll have a very specific kind of experience. And there's something about the clarity of the rules that lets you into another kind of experience. Let me give you two analogies and I'll stop talking because I can see that you're jittering with excitement. So first analogy, this is in my games book. I think this is maybe the most important part of the book for someone that has the worries like you. So I was worried about this thing about how games could possibly produce freedom, how rigid rules could ever produce freedom. And I remembered something a yoga teacher had told to me, which is that the rigidity of the specification of yoga poses is actually the thing that helps you find flexibility. And the reason is that when we act out of habit, we tend to repeat the same kind of postures and we don't explore new spaces. And the rigidity of the rules forces you, the rigidity of a specification of a yoga pose forces you out of your normal posture and to discover something new. Now, it would be different if I told you to hold triangle pose forever. That would not be freedom. But yeah. If you to temporarily use the rigidity to find something new and then be able to step back from it and integrate it into your life, there's a place where rigidity is a tool for exploration. Here's another thing. I've been thinking a lot about recipes and different kinds of recipes. Ooh. And I think here's one thing I can say. I spent a lot of my life cooking. And there's a certain kind of person that can never not follow the recipe and has to follow the recipe absolutely precisely and can never deviate from it. And you think like what you want to say is like, come on, like be free. Like you can modify these things. You can explore. But there's another kind of person that never will follow a recipe at all. And what I've noticed, so I had a buddy who's a really good cook, very Western European, and he would try to cook like Japanese. He would try to cook like Indian. And he would be like, I don't need recipes. I'm not that kind of person. What would happen is what would come out of his kitchen was not Japanese or Indian, but just like, you know, a Western stew that used udon noodles, right? And there's something about, it's both the case that once you learn a cuisine, you can improvise, but also the process of learning something completely novel to you involves actually rigidly following the recipes. Because I was originally taught to cook, you know, I'm Vietnamese, but my mother never taught me to cook because I'm a boy, and we can talk about that later.
This is its own topic.
Yeah. But I was originally trained to cook kind of like French Italian, but the way to learn for me to cook things like Japanese or Sichuan or Turkish is in the beginning to ignore my instincts and to follow the recipe precisely, because it will push me into a space where I don't have instincts, where I would never be as spare in my natural cooking as the Japanese cookbook tells me to do. So there's this funky way in which the rigidity of rules is both a prison and also a way in. And that's like the center of the thing. But the crucial thing about games, again, is you have choice. You can step into it. You can step out of it. Although it's really weird if you, and this is the other thing that's really hard to understand. It usually doesn't work in most cases, if you modify the rules of the game on the fly during the game. You have to commit yourself for a period of time. That was a bunch of stew for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, we're just going to keep throwing this stuff back and forth. I mean, the first thing to say when you're talking about recipes, the first thing I thought of was cocktails. I mean, I like making cocktails. I'm not that experimental with it, but I learned how to make cocktails from this book called The Art of Mixing Drinks. I don't remember. It's by Imbrewery. So it's this famous cocktail making book. And it's filled with recipes. I mean, just every kind of recipe you could want for every kind of cocktail that existed in 1957 or whenever when this book was made. And he also says, you don't want these recipes. You know, I'm going to tell you what a cocktail is and how you make one, which is essentially a certain amount of liquor and then something that smooths and sweetens and then something else that makes it, you know, kind of astringent, and the rough ratio for these three things. And I'll give you a few examples. And then he says, and now you're done. Now you know how to make every drink in the world. It's 6 parts liquor, 2 parts sweetener, 1 part astringent. And you can literally invent every cocktail ever invented and have it taste good. And if you want to switch it to 7-2-1 or 8-3-2, that's also fine. And I feel like every cocktail I make is delicious by following but also modifying these rules. And I have friends who make cocktails and they're like, I've got this recipe, and they name it and they make it precisely to the recipe book. And sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. But I feel like they don't know how to make cocktails, if that makes sense. Maybe this takes us into a whole different set of, this gets into a question of like automatons and artificial intelligence or something, but I don't think they know how to make cocktails. And it's like, well, didn't they just make you a cocktail and it's good? Like, well, yes, but they didn't actually make a cocktail. They don't know how to make a cocktail. They only know how to follow a recipe. But I take your point that if Imbri's book had been like one sentence and it was like, no one knows what a cocktail truly is, semicolon, make your own, I would never have learned the kind of freewheeling cocktail making style that I have that came out of first Imbri's rigid application of discipline to me. Like, you know, if it has seltzer in it, it's not a cocktail, it's something else. Shut the fuck up. Stop calling a highball a cocktail. And I was like, oh my God, what? This guy's such an asshole. But he doesn't say you can't make highballs. He just says it's a different thing and it has different rules and you have to understand. I think that might apply to the question of, well, I don't know. I'm just going to stop talking and see if you have anything to say in response.
Yeah, no, there's, like this is,
in a corner.
Let me say the biggest thing that I want to say, which is, the end point of the book I'm trying to write right now is to say what you just said about a person that follows the recipe and doesn't understand the thing behind it for recipes is also what I think is going wrong with a person whose personal value system is set by metrics. They are following, a recipe for what's important in their life, and they don't actually understand what's important. But this is, here's the huge but. I mean, this is why I think we're in the same space of like being worried about this stuff, because so I want to say that it is both the case that true cooking involves understanding a dish as a possibility space where you can make different decisions and push it in different ways, and there's a space to explore. And on the other hand, while I improvise 95% of my cocktails, sometimes following a recipe precisely and making myself do it will give me a new idea for a form of balance that I would never have gotten to on my own, because that precision is the way it's been communicated. So John Thorne, who's one of my favorite food writers, this is going to show up in the book. John Thorne is this amazing food writer. And he has this, he was also, it turns out, a philosophy undergraduate, which is totally unsurprising. He has this passage where he's talking about different kinds of rice and beans dishes and how like that you can modulate this to respond to that, and you don't have the sweet element, so you add this instead. And he says, because what's important here is the difference between a recipe and a dish. A dish is a live thing, an idea of balance in a creative cook's head that has to be remade anew every time in response to changing circumstances. And a recipe is a dead thing, a writing down of how a creative cook made something once. And then he admits, and this is the most crucial part, that you can't write a dish down into a book and transmit it. And he admits, and I think this is true for me too, that he learns a lot of his dishes through recipes that have been written down. But also, you have to make, what he says, you have to make the recipe, but also treat it not as the final thing, but as the finger pointing to the live thing behind it. But also, the recipe is the gateway. And that, I mean, that thought for me is really important. And you might think like, you might think that's what's going on with the rigidity of games, right? Like there's something core, there's something about the clarity of the rules that gets everyone into precisely the same, to find a new kind of action and find a new mindset and get there and have everyone be in exactly the same mindset for once, which is not really possible without explicit rule sets. By the way, okay, this will entertain you since this is the everyday anarchism. One of the first ideas I had, I should summarize for your readers very briefly my view of games. That might help because I think you and I know it and we're talking about it.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Sorry.
So I'm taking off from Bernard Suits, who's this brilliant philosopher of games, has a definition of games. And the short way to put it is that what a game is, to play a game is to voluntarily take on unnecessary obstacles in order to make possible a certain kind of activity. Right. His more complicated way of putting it is that in every game, there's a thing called a prelusory goal, which is the goal that you're after stated in kind of like plain physical terms, like the goal is to pass the ball through the net, or the goal is to pass the finish line. But then there are things he calls constitutive rules, and the constitutive rules place constraints. You have to dribble, right? You have to face opponents, or you have to run to the end of the finish line following this course. You can't take a taxi or an Uber. And the thing he points out is the losery goal, the true goal of the game, is reaching the pre-losery goal inside the constitutive rules. So making a basket is not merely getting the ball through the net. Making a basket, if you pass the ball through the net while you're on a stepladder, that's not making a basket. Making a basket is hitting that goal inside a certain constraint set. Finishing a marathon is not just passing that point in space, but doing it having followed a certain course. So what playing a game is something where the constraints are integral to what it is that you're doing. And I ended up saying that what this shows us is that games are. So I combined that thought with a thought from my favorite board game designer, Rainer Knizia, where Knizia says that the most important tool in his game design toolbox is the point system, because the point system tells the players what to care about. It sets their desires in the game. And I combine this to have a view that something like what a game does is it specifies an alternate agency, where that agency is here's a set of abilities, but here's also what you want. And then when you play a game, you step in to an alternate practical agency where you have different cares and different ways of acting. And so game designers use the medium of agency itself to sculpt something like a specific kind of action that you get through the game. So that's the background view. And one thing I should say that might entertain you is I got to this view in part because I was reading a bunch of people that thought, oh, games are an art form because they're kind of fiction. And I was like, that's not right. They're rule sets. And my first opening thought was games are actually toy governments. Is the tools of governmentality turned to artistic and playful purposes. Rule sets and incentive manipulation, but for fun.
Yeah. Yes. This is exactly the point. This is exactly the point that I was getting at in terms of following these bureaucratic procedures. Right. I'm astonished at the way that you and I are taking this question on in these really similar ways from these two different angles. I completely agree. To respond briefly to a number of things, first, I want to go back something I meant to say earlier when you mentioned, there's an anarchist or Marxist critique of the way of thinking about, activities as useless or useful. It's my view, and I think plenty of Marxists would contest this, that actually the Marxists are totally also into productivity and the factory mindset. They might want the factory making up. You want to weigh in on this?
Oh, yeah. So I should say this is one of the most two interesting points for this. So Langdon Winner has this great article called Do Artifacts Have Politics? He's a philosopher of technology. And I teach him in my classes. And he's trying to talk about this productivity mindset, this like output-oriented mindset. And he ends up not pegging it to capitalism, which is what most people do, but pegging it to the ethos of the factory, in which follow a standard to maximize productivity. And he thinks this is why he thinks it's a technological thing. He thinks people that buy into the ethos of the factory, be they capitalist or communist, end up obsessed with this standardized into outcomes mindset. And then he finds this passage, which blows my mind, from Engels.
Yeah.
Where Engels says, this will play right into your interest, where Engels says, in order to maximize productivity in a factory, we need to have standardized activity, but this is not people's natural inclination. Their inclination is to freely do things as they want, which is why authoritarianism is the correct mindset for the factory, which is why we should be authoritarians. Yeah. This is one of those things you read, you're like, yeah, right? And But by the way, we should well, say,
I mean,
that,
I just want to break in and say, you feel that way if you read that, if you're a Marxist, but if you've been reading Graeber and Kropotkin, right, and Emma Goldman, you're just like, I fucking knew those guys. I fucking knew they were all asshole authoritarians. Yeah.
By the way, I should say before we go on that I will fess up. I'm not an avowed anarchist for reasons we can talk about. I am nauseatingly worried about all proposed human organization systems, and I have no solution. So, but then, so
I would say not. I would say that counts as an anarchist under my definition. Okay, in that if you don't have a stated, clear answer for how to organize society that's going to be good, and your idea is better than everyone else's, and we should implement it, that to me is anarchism. But other anarchists and non-anarchists disagree.
Yeah. So James Scott, the interesting thing about Seeing Like a State, which is something that I would recommend to everyone in this space, it's a remarkable book. It's also a book to be suspicious of in a bunch of ways, because it's a book about, it's a book criticizing grand sweeping visions, which is itself a grand sweeping vision. But the basic thesis of Seeing Like a State is that states, and by states he means any kind of large organized institution, and he includes both corporations, globalized capitalisms, and governments, and nonprofit bureaucracies, and centralized communist states. They can only see the parts of the world that they can process through a large-scale bureaucratic information processing system. And so only those parts of the world are legible to the state. And so the state has a motive to make the world more legible to it, to transform it into ways that are more seeable to it. And so for Scott's examples are all examples of the state transforming the agricultural landscape into something like monocultures to make it more efficient and more manageable. I should say, by the way, that my interest here is that my claim in my book is going to be something like Scott's worries also apply to values, and the way the state makes people's values more legible to it is gamification and getting everyone oriented on the same public metric. But the interesting thing about Scott is that Scott alternates chapters in which he finds this. I mean, Scott is an avowed anarchist, although, again, the kind of anarchist who is a tenured professor at Yale. So,
well, yeah, you know. I mean, that's the, well, anyways, go ahead. Yeah.
So, but Scott alternates finding this in global capital markets and in bureaucratic communist states. And I would say for the intellectuals watching along at home that Scott believes both Marxist critiques of capital and Hayek's critique of centralized socialist bureaucracies. And what Scott is trying to find underneath it is a synthesis that involves a worry about information pipeline problems. And I've been trying to work this out, because I think a lot of people look at the kinds of effects that we are worried about this kind of inhumanity of everyone hopping onto a metric. And what they find in it is some kind of like malicious, you know, oppressive instinct. And I think this is more worrying to me. What Scott finds is the basic problem of a large-scale organization needing to cope with the kind of information compression it needs to do in order to function. And that information compression involves, we can talk a lot more about this. This is something where I think Scott is drawing on this really rich vein of literature about metrics that I find fascinating. But one way to put it is that what metrics do is they compress and organize information into a singular form, so someone at the center can have all of it summarized for them, which requires a kind of systematic decontextualization. And so he thinks that you find this in capital markets, right? Like you find this in what prices do. They remove tons of information to generate a single number. But you also find this in socialist states that reduce various areas to production numbers, right? There's a question about whether Scott has actually taken into account every possible form of human organization. But the basic insight is something like what you're seeing in these two different, supposedly different information schemes is a problem about the scaling up of information. And what I've been lately thinking is that the core problem here is not maliciousness, but just scale, about scale organization, which is why Scott is an anarchist.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is maybe the most common question I get is like, you know, what do you do about the scale problem? And, you know, Graeber has answers of how to solve the scale problem. I myself, I guess this is one place where I'm hew more traditionally to an anarchist thing, which is maybe, and this Graeber doesn't like this answer, maybe we just don't need that much scale. That I'll leave that aside for now, and I'll talk about it more, if not in this conversation later on. But I'm struck by, again, to go back, you've generated enough ideas for 10 hours. To this question of, it does seem like we've gamified school. And by reducing school to a few metrics or KPIs, so those are basically test scores, GPA, and then weirdly, extracurriculars, when I teach this to my students, is one of the things that trips them up. And they're like, wait, if all that matters is metrics, why does it matter that I be on the cheer team? And I'm like, I don't exactly know, but let's just say they put the cheer team as one of the metrics, like the number of clubs you have, and if you're president of them, that becomes, and they're like, oh, so I'm being graded in an inhuman way about whether I am a valuable human. And I'm like, yes, that's just part of the system. So we have all these metrics, but when I talk to it with my students, they think about it and they agree. This is the scale problem. They agree. This is all bad. All the metrics are bad. GPA is bad. SATs are bad. None of them help the avowed goal within the school or classroom or the student of learning, if that is the avowed goal. And then they realize the goal of the school is not that they learn. It's precisely as you say, that they prove via numbers that they have learned more than the other students in the class with them. And therefore, when they do the next stage, they can leap above their peers and not go to some lowly, pathetic institution like UNC Chapel Hill, but a real place like Harvard or Stanford, where it counts more. And they agree, as far as their high school is concerned, or indeed as far as my classroom is concerned, grades are totally useless and all these mechanics of metricization are not necessary. But if you want to feed, quote, the best students to go from undergrads in Chapel Hill to Harvard law students, and then the second best students to be Michigan law students, et cetera, you need this number that as you say, transfers easily. So then one option, this again, this is like the capital A anarchist option, is just like, fuck scale, just fuck it. But then people worry that's, you know, the result is what they call anarchy, right? The collapse of all institutions. And I don't know, right now I'm not too worried about that anarchy. I'm happy to push in that direction as far as possible, because I know I'm pushing a very, very, very big machine. I right now, all I know is it's killing our students. I mean, literally in some cases, killing them to be put into this meat grinder, even though, as you say, in the right place and time of your choosing, following rules for points and beating other people can be tons of fun.
I have so much to say about this. The first thing I should say is I now have a unit in my intro ethics class, my intro philosophy class, where on the first week we read Harry Frankfurt's paper on bullshit, where he defines, he asks what bullshit is. And he says that he ends up saying that bullshit is different from lies because a liar cares about the truth but is manipulating your view of the truth, where the bullshitter doesn't care about the truth at all. So he ends up saying something like, what bullshit is when you like pervert something away from its true end. Like talk should be about truth, but now it's something else. And then I give them the paper Making the Grade, which is a history of the American grading scheme and how it arose from the interests of basically employers who wanted a standard certification of employee skill. And then on the third day, I just walk in and I say, okay, is grading bullshit? And I open the door and everyone has this like heartfelt, actually the best result of this ever was that. So I try to ungrade my classes, but I realized I can't ungrade my intro class, because what happens is the students are like, well, I love this class, but I can't come because I don't need to work for this and I need to work harder to get my grade in my other classes. So they stop coming. So I can't ungrade that class. And when we went through this whole thing, one of my students, my best student, stood up from the back row and said, "So you still grade your class?" And I explained why. And he said, "You're a fucking hypocrite." And he walked out the door and he never came back to class, which I think is actually a great result.
In its own way.
So that's one thing I want to say, but there's another. So here is a very friendly story to, I think, what you're saying, which is something like grades are the imposition of an external set of interests that about the, you know, the market trying to turn people, all the stuff you said. That's one way to put it. I'm a little worried that that's not a complete story, that again, that attributes a malicious intent, which may be true here, but is not the only mechanic working. So let me try to get us to another place. So another possible story is that grades are a kind of data, and any system at scale operating trying to comprehend itself needs some kind of data system. And I mean, one way to put it is I'm a little worried that the same thing that we worry about with this kind of soul-crushing metric is also the same thing that's making science work, which is the reason I'm not dead. I mean, honestly, like, information processing at scale is probably responsible for me not being dead. And I'm worried that it's the same tendency in both. And anyway, so let me go back. Let me download some STS stuff on metrics into your brain and see what you think about this. So STS, I just use this acronym, is Science and Technology Studies. It spawned off of a few fields, including philosophy of science, in the 70s from people like Ian Hacking and Bruno Latour. And it became this incredibly rich and interesting field that most people ignore. And one of the most interesting parts of it is this field called basically the study of quantification and the culture of quantification. So Theodore Porter is this key figure. He has this book called Trust in Numbers, which is an extraordinary book. Have you read this book?
I've read about it, but I have not read it itself, unfortunately.
It's so good. So what he says, what he ends up saying, and this has kind of become the going theory, what he ends up saying is that qualitative information and quantitative information, are good at different things. They're both powerful. They're good at different things. So qualitative information is rich, context-sensitive, dynamic, open-ended, and responsive to what's going on, but it travels badly between contexts. Quantitative information, as we find it in institutions, works by identifying some kind of context-invariant kernel and then stripping off the high-context information. And so the kernel can travel. Different people from different contexts can collect into the kernel, and then it can aggregate easily. So qualitative information, just think like, you know, written evaluations of your students. And you can see there, it's so sensitive, it's so responsive, you can pick up on different things. But it's A, not comprehensible to the business dean, and B, and here's something I think that we can say without this maliciousness. If I have to choose, if I have to make a choice about which students to admit, and I'm facing 1,000 applications, I can't read all of their qualitative evaluations. They don't aggregate, right? So GPA is the quantitative set of information, right? It is a particular kernel that is minimized, but is comprehensible with a stable meaning at scale. And so different people can report into the same scale, and then it can aggregate easily. So exactly the thing that makes it insensitive is the thing that makes it comprehensible and aggregatable at scale. So this is, Porter's account is still old, kind of old, but as far as I can tell, if you're interested in this stuff, the philosopher of data right now is Sabina Leonelli, and her view, as far as I can tell, is a nuanced, technicaled up version of Porter's view. So her view about data, and this is scientific data, is scientific data is information that's been prepared to travel to, be understood by, and be used by people from faraway contexts with unexpected interests and unexpected uses. So you can compare this to Porter's original account, which is what he says is that information is the kind of understanding that's been prepared to be understood by distant contextless strangers. So this is called the portability theory of data. And one of the things that I get, and this is, by the way, if you're interested in this stuff, you should read Porter, and then for the updated version, Sabina Leonelli's data-centric biology book, which is incredible. And here's the nauseating heart of my worry. It is the very same mechanism of making data portable and thus aggregatable at scale that is responsible both for the dehumanizing aspect of GPA and for science's ability to, like, you know, come up with vaccines and come up, right? It is that the scale of data has this vast power, and the vast power is based on its ability to aggregate across many contexts, which involves context stripping. Does it make sense? So this is in a sense what I need. When Scott says that state, only certain kinds of things are legible to the state, this is the view that's really filling it out for me. By the way, for the geeks at home, Scott is openly influenced by Theodore Porter's Trust in Numbers, but it's this view, this kind of like power at scale through decontextualization, which I think is kind of the most essential thought from this realm.
Okay. I'm going to try and say a couple of things quickly because we're running out of time, and I don't want the listeners hearing my voice too much. So I guess I'm going to try and give three really quick responses to potential solutions to the problem you just identified, which is to say the same system that is killing our students is also saving their lives, starting with the Human Genome Project into mRNA vaccines. So the first one is, this is the really, really easy, like, communist or socialist answers. Like you said, like, you've got 1,000 students, but not that many spots. Well, that sounds like a fucking resource distribution problem. Yep. We just go take all of Jeff Bezos's money and we make 1,000 spots, right? Like, this is the, like, easy communist answer. Whenever I say this to people, they get really mad because they're like, that's not a serious response. You're not thinking. And I'm like, well, maybe it really is just that simple. So I'm going to throw that out there and we don't have to respond to it. I can tell you no one likes this answer. The next question is the anarcho-primitivist one, which is like, yes. Freud gives a version of this in Civilization and his Discontents. It's like, yes, okay, the technology saved my life. The mRNA vaccine saved my life. On the other hand, it was the technology that brought the virus across continents. So, like, let's just live in huts. And yeah, some people will die of bacteria because there's no antibiotics, but also everyone will only eat whole grains and everyone will get all the exercise that all the scientists are always telling us to get. And we'll just live a happier, simpler, better life without technology. You can get this from William Morris, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not advancing that idea either, but I wanted to throw both those two out as options. Where I would try and actually intervene here from my own point of view is the problem is not metrics and data that crisscrosses the globe and makes things intelligible. The problem is that there are as few metrics and paths as possible for every single thing we would want to test and transform a young person into being, which is another way of saying we laugh at young people because they say, why do I have to take calculus? I, you know, want to be a poet. And in fact, that we shouldn't laugh at them. We should try and ensure some sort of liberal arts education that is wide ranging, but we should also stop culling people and failing people out of the meritocracy because they can't do certain things when maybe they could do other things. So the problem is not that there is numbers, but that there is one number or two, GPA and test scores for literally everything you want to do. And a more flexible education system and a more flexible society wouldn't say there's, you know, good students, which is top 10%, and bad students, which is the bottom 90%. But there's lots of different skills and lots of different paths, and we can be counting those and doing culling and sorting maybe but it needs to be within some sort of more flexible system.
I mean,
I don't know. Yeah.
In a sense, this is exactly what I want to say with the games. The thing that makes games beautiful, the core difference between metrics and games is precisely that you have your choice of an endless number of games. And also, I think crucially, games don't have to interoperate with each other. The point systems in each game aren't beholden to the point systems in another game. So let me try something on you. This is new, but I think you might be the person to find this maybe interesting or tell me it's wrong. I've been working on this book. It's called The Score. It's about scoring systems. That's what it says it's about, which you find in games and institutions. And my working theory of the score is that it's a quantified evaluation that produces a singular verdict into an official record. And its goal is to produce a singular verdict. And one thing I can, the thought that I've been obsessed with is that most people assume that if you have a game or a competition, you have to have a scoring system and a singular verdict. But that's just false. So you can have a skateboarding competition where people go to the park and compete for the coolest trick and no singular verdict, right? Everyone, right? You can have a cooking competition at your house and people can decide what the best dish is, but you don't need an agreement. You don't need a singular verdict. You need a singular verdict when you have a cash prize to give away, when only two people can go to national, something like that, right? When you have a pressure to make some official sort. So the interesting thing for me is that, how do I put this? This is like, tell me if this is interesting or if this is obscure, because this is literally a thought from this week. The interesting thing about games versus institutional metrics is each game produces a singular verdict, but you don't need a singular verdict across games, right? You don't need to compare. You're like, well, who's better, the world champion yo-yoer or like the person? Doesn't matter. Where part of the thing about GPA and other metrics is there's a pressure for them to interoperate. Mm-hmm. And so you don't, what this gives you is, I mean, for me, what's special about games is not only can you pick the game, you can mod your games. If you want to mod your D&D system or come up with a new speedrunning variant that changes the game, then people are going to say, like, how do I compare this to other games? How do I know if when I played modded some variant Dungeons and Dragons, whether I did better than you did or not? The answer is we don't care. We don't care about which of the point, how to translate between the point systems, right? And this thought should predict will play into your anarchist sensibilities, right? It's the need for interoperation which is crucial. Now, here's the pessimistic worry. Everything I've seen in the empirical literature on metrics says that the tendency of institutions is always to focus on a small number of metrics. And I've been starting to suspect that there's a reason for this. And the reason is precisely the fact that arises from the how little attention we need and how thin something needs to be to interconnect all these different contexts, right? There's something about the fact that since the contexts are so, the more different the context, the thinner the amount of information that's going to travel between them. And so there's this weird thought. And again, I think you, the anarchist, will love this, that it is precisely the need to make many different contexts communicate and coordinate, which is the origin of this thinness of information. Okay, I'm going to stop for a bit. What do you think?
I think the thing that I was trying to fumble to about why are we using the same set of numbers to evaluate every student no matter what they want to do, and the thing that you are describing in terms of institution context, I think those the same thing. Yeah. I think you and I completely agree on this problem. One option is to say that this is a problem about, you know, and this is a very political anarchist thing to say, that this is a problem because we have centralized power, wealth, capital, everything as much as possible. And all we need is a more diffuse and diverse set of institutions that are less interested in operating with one another. In fact, being different from the other set of institutions is if that's seen as a good instead of a bad, then you can still have your numbers. There's too many ways to go with this. I mean, one way, let me just try this. Something from my background is, late in his life, Dewey went to talk to, you know, a bunch of progressive educators, Deweyites, maybe you could call them, who he thought were wrong about everything. You know, it was a tragic moment that he stood up in front of a group of, he was addressing like the American Progressive Educators Association, which you could like subtitle the like John Dewey fan club. And Dewey stood up, he's like 90 at this time. I think maybe he didn't even stand up. Like he wasn't even well enough to read the speech, but he wrote it. Maybe he gave it, I can't remember. And he's like, you guys got this all wrong because you did what I told you to do, which was experiment in schools and find different ways and methods of doing, which is science or philosophy. And he says, and this would have been shocking to them, we can use these same words for the same thing, science or philosophy, same thing. And then, and this is shocking because science is good and concrete and empirical, and philosophy is diffuse and bad and fuzzy. And then he says, but the problem is, as soon as you had this process that you liked, you tried to standardize it and you tried to export it. You experimented and found this new thing, and then you tried to impose it everywhere, which prevented every other school from experimenting. And so out of the scientific process, and you can see this is why I'm thinking about mRNA and James Scott and everything, out of the scientific process, which is open and collaborative and experimental, comes through the power of metrics and standardization something that is closed and prevents people from exploring new ideas. And it's almost this dialectical thing that, in an attempt to do this good thing, science, you create an environment that stifles science. And I think that's what you're talking about. Maybe you'll have to tell me.
I mean, the Dewey moment is great. This is, in some sense, this is the thing. So one of the things I noted recently was this interesting symmetry between James Scott and then this philosopher of science, Nancy Cartwright, who's incredible. And what Scott says is something like, in his late chapters on the study in studies in agriculture, he says something like, look, there's this incredibly rich, sustainable technique we have called polycropping, where you permit lots of different plants to grow on top of each other and interact and coordinate. And it's incredibly powerful, but it requires high tuning to the local environment and microclimate. So it requires a highly expert and autonomous farmer. And it isn't amenable to the methods of the state. So the state, he says, tends toward monocropping, where monocropping is centralizing an agricultural discovery system. You go to an agricultural lab at like UC Davis, you have a greenhouse, you figure out what works best. And then that technique won't work well unless you go to the rest of the world and change it to look like that greenhouse. That's a technique that's a low adaptable technique. And so the way to make it work is to force the rest of the world to be as much like the greenhouse as possible, which involves fertilizer, pesticides, all that stuff. Let me skip over. So Nancy Cartwright, incredible pragmatist philosopher of science. I'm not 100% sure, but I would guess in explicitly she would think of herself in the Deweyan tradition. That's just a guess. What she says is, we seem to assume that physics is fundamental and the most powerful science, but actually there are plenty of highly chaotic situations where the methods of physics don't work very well. And the way we make the methods of physics work really well is we alter the world to make it look as much like the laboratory as possible. So we put shielding on our instruments. We make space shuttles incredibly controlled shielded environments so they're like the lab. And then the things that we figure out in the lab can work there. And so we create... She thinks that it's that physics isn't that the clean formulations of theoretical physics work. We've learned that they work in lab-like environments. So we alter parts of the world in very controlled, closed, encased physical objects to be lab-like in order to make our rules of physics work. Does that make sense?
Yes, it absolutely makes sense. I keep telling myself I need to stop talking, but I'll say this, which is when you hear people, and I want to be clear, when I was talking earlier about this system that dehumanizes and destroys our students, I don't think it's malevolent at all. It's an attempt. Like if you look at like a progressive person who's going to defend it in the New York Times opinion page, it's an attempt to do this Rawlsian thing of finding the best people and reward them a lot, but so that they can do really good work and make the best world, and that will lift all of us up. I don't think it works, but that's the idea behind it. But if you talk to these people, or they're writing the New York Times, like David Leonhardt or Jessica Gross, and they're like, blah, 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 test scores are so great. And then they'll say, standardized testing is the best way of predicting a student's GPA in college. And it's like, well, that's, is it possible you've created a college that is designed to correlate with standardized testing?
Okay, let me see if this is a wild leap. This is, sorry, because we seem to be thinking very sympathetically, I'm like trying to, instead of like explaining the things I know, I want to tell you about the things that I'm barely figuring out and then have okay. You help me.
I'm going to break in again. I'm sorry. I hope I'm not breaking your conversation. So first of all, your concentration, this is an unusual episode of this show. And to me, like the ideal version, because it's two people thinking together rather than someone asking questions and someone else giving answers. This is not something that you know and I'm asking. We're working through this together and we're both trying it out. That's incredibly unusual. Secondly, this does not have to be the end. This podcast episode does not have to be our only engagement. But by all means, try these ideas out on me because okay. You're right. You and I are in most ways pretty sympathetic.
So, okay, there's this other paper I wrote that I feel is deeply related to this stuff, and maybe you can tell me why. So I have this paper called Transparency is Surveillance, and it's based on this moment from the philosopher Onara O'Neill. She has this paper. She was working in bioethics at the time and studying hospitals. She's a Kantian ethicist. And she has this moment. It's just a paragraph where she says, people think that transparency and trust go together, but transparency and trust are actually deeply opposed because transparency asks experts to explain themselves to non-experts, and they can't because their reasons are incomprehensible to non-experts. So they'll deceive, they'll write fake reasons. And I ended up in my paper saying something like, it's not just that, it's that a lot, in many cases, experts in transparency regimes will only take the actions like they can justify. And so to that extent, they'll be confining themselves to non-expert explicable reasons. And so they will lose some degree of their expertise. And what this looks like, I mean, for me, what this looks like is I used to, one of my interests in metrics came from being the education learnings outcome liaison for my last department, which meant I had to generate metrics that proved that the philosophy department wasn't bullshitting and actually educating our students in a way that was comprehensible to the Utah State Legislature. And here's my real worry. My worry is, I think there's a way in that says like, metrics bad. And I don't think that's the real worry. For me, the real worry is that transparency metrics actually do the work of exposing corruption and exposing bias by forcing things to be explicable outside of a closed circle to the outside world. And at the same time, they do the work of removing sensitivity, removing expert understanding, right? So, I mean, I think here's the worry. So imagine a bunch of philosophers, right? We want to say like, oh, trust us, we're educating our students well. It could be that we're an incredibly biased old boys network of like shitty old white dudes just pushing this like European vision, and that exposure to that transparency would force that into the light, right? Or it could be that the philosophers understand some sensitive, delicate thing about teaching critical reasoning. And that's not something that could be explained to the outside public using some quick metric like SAT scores, and that transparency would shatter that. So my worry is that both those things are true. One of the things that you find over and over again in the literature on quantification, even the worst critic of metrics will say something like, but yes, also clear, simple numbers are how we showed that some institution was radically racist and radically misogynist, and that like people didn't believe us until we got the numbers about the hiring ratios of white versus black, men versus women, versus and how, say, white men were radically overhired, even given the fact that on every standardized test we have, right, they that should, right? So here, there's this, so the, does that make sense? Like there's this worry I have that the large scale publicity and portability and comprehensibility here is not valueless. It does a huge amount for us with a very high cost. And I think, of course, what you are going to want to say is, well, all these costs are only endemic to these large scale institutions.
I'm guilty as charged.
Right. But I mean, I don't know. There's also reasons. I mean, I guess the reason I'm not as much of an anarchist as you is that I'm not as optimistic. Because I think if you let the world splinter off into lots of small self-governing segments, many of them are likely to be racist, evil, and shitty. And for every single large scale metrified shit show, we also have some federal intervention into a racist elementary school, right, where we expose the racism using something like a metric. So this is the heart. This is why I think I'm much more nauseous about this material than you are, because I both have this deep worry about large-scale information collectivization, but also this deep worry about unorganized tribal power structures and how crappy that can be too. Sorry, does that make sense at all, or am I just like off up my own ass?
No, every single thing you said makes sense and comes exactly out of the conversation we've had for the last hour, and connects to every bit of work I have been doing in the 2.5 years I've been doing this podcast. Absolutely, 100%. Because what I was going to say was, yes, what you are looking for, what you're looking for is polycropping, and you're also right that if you look at, say, the history of the United States can be read, and I used to read it this way, as a series of good interventions, often by the federal government, into, you know, absolutely monstrous communities doing terrible things, frequently, you know, related to race, but that's not the only version. Race is not the only place where we can tell this story. We can certainly tell it with women and other minorities and other, you know, terrible things that various communities have been up to. The reason why I'm more optimistic than you are about, I want to say polycropping governments, is long and complicated, and versions of it the listeners of this podcast have already heard. So I don't want to go into it in too depth, except to say if you look at, to do this in terms of U.S. history, you can think of this in terms of like the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists. And what the Anti-Federalists wanted, I think, was a version of anarchy. Tom Paine wants a version of anarchy. But the person who we get as the spokesman is Thomas Jefferson. And Thomas Jefferson wants a almost anarchist version of utopia, where he wants the yeoman farmer and blah, blah, blah. And he's also against slavery and all of these things. But actually, what ends up becoming the Anti-Federalist position is this thing that we call states' rights, which is still with us, which doesn't say we should have a bunch of people being autonomous and a bunch of autonomous communities that come together when they want to, but don't come together when they don't want to. And this includes people. But it's actually to say we should have these things called state governments, because some of them are okay with slaveries, with slavery, and these state governments should be primarily made up of these enormous plantations, which are ruled by one guy in the center. And this has, in the American context, permanently discredited, and I know why, the set of ideas associated with Thomas Jefferson, because as wonderful an anarchist as they sound, Hamilton called it right. These anarchist ideas were actually a stalking horse for Jefferson and his buddies being the only people with power and running literal slave regimes. Perhaps foolishly, I think we can try again with the acknowledgement that there's no white knight who's going to save us if it goes wrong, but also with the belief, and yes, I share this with people like James Scott, that, you know, the federal government is also not going to be a white knight and come in and save you. And when the federal government does act, this is my new reading, it tends to act because of grassroots coalitions of citizens who force its hand. So actually what looks like top-down intervention to save us because, oh, you know, the regulators found the metrics. Probably the regulators didn't find the metrics. Probably there was a letter-writing campaign first, and a bunch of moms got angry, and that is when the regulators get involved. And so what looks like governmental action is actually direct democracy.
I have a book for you, and then I have a proposed ending note for this conversation. So you might find really interesting William Derringer's book, Calculated Value, which I think about a lot. Okay. So there's a standard story in the literature I read that says that metrics are always part of the government. They're always part of a surveillance and control structure. And it comes out of a bunch of people, kind of like Foucault and post-Foucauldian scholars, who are using the French state as an example. And in the French state, indeed, the primary keeper of statistics was a government organization that did seem to be used for management and power. William Derringer says, but that's not the only possibility. The history of England is different. And in the history of England, what he shows is that what you had was a wildly corrupt crown and large-scale metrics arising from an organization of kind of like crown critics who started trying to collect various metrics about taxation rates and import rates and all this stuff in order to call the crown out on its bullshit. Interpret that how you will, but I think it's super interesting. So here's, I think, the last thing we can say. I think the two of us have an almost identical utopian vision and a slightly different sense of pessimism about human nature. So I think we both agree that games are a model of utopia. By the way, this is the end of Suits' Grasshopper. Suits says in utopia, when we solved all our practical problems, we would play games. And that means games are the meaning of life. I think we're putting it to a slightly different use, which is the games are a model of strict cooperative rule sets that are useful for their strictness, but also which people can freely move between and tune to their own ends, and that you can get the best part of rules and the best part of freedom from this like utopian vision of games. I think the main difference between you and me is you believe that's possible. And I probably think that human beings are too shitty to ever get there. And so I'm kind of looking for the shitty, half-assed, closest hack we can get there, given the fact that we're not actually nice enough to actually live there, and that some asshole will always create a powerful state to beat up on the anarchists.
So, can we just try, though? Can't we try?
Maybe.
Maybe. Well, okay. I'm going to keep trying. This has been, you know, just an utterly scintillating conversation. Thank you so much, T, for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for helping me think through the morass I'm in right now.
Yeah, well, you're right in the thick of it. And, well, I've got some other thoughts, but perhaps I'll air them with you later. This has been, say the name of it. It's Art as Agency.
So my book is called Games, Agency as Art. That's the one that's already out. That's the study of games. If people are interested, there's a bunch of other papers on the metric stuff out. Probably the most readable is called How Twitter Gamifies Communication. But the central paper that's come out, the pair is, one is called Value Capture, about metrics capturing values, and the other is called Transparency and Surveillance. And then I have a book coming out that I'm writing right now called The Score. Who knows when I'll actually get it done.
Yeah. All right. And this has been a run through for some of the ideas from The Score. All right. I'll put links to that in the show notes. And thanks again.
Thank you.